with a typed message that read, "It would be a mistake to spend the money. The IRS is a phone call away." The envelope had been postmarked in Clanton on Wednesday, the day after the funeral, and was addressed to the family of Judge Attlee at Maple Run. Ray placed it aside while he scanned the other cards and letters. They were all the same at this point, and he'd read enough. The pink one sat there like a loaded gun, waiting for him to return to it. He repeated the threat on the balcony as he grasped the railing and tried to analyze things. He mumbled the words in the kitchen as he fixed more coffee. He'd left the note on the table, so he could see it from any part of his rambling den. Back on the balcony, he watched the foot traffic pick up as noon approached, and anyone who glanced up was a person who might know about the money. Bury a fortune, then realize you're hiding it from someone, and your imagination can get crazy. The money didn't belong to him, and it was certainly enough to get him stalked, followed, watched, reported, even hurt. Then he laughed at his own paranoia. "I will not live like this," he said, and went to take a shower. Whoever it was knew exactly where the judge had hidden the money. "Make a list," Ray told himself, as he sat on the edge of his bed naked with water dripping onto the floor. The felon who cut the lawn once a week. Perhaps he was a smooth talker who'd befriended the judge and spent time in the house. Entry was easy. When the judge sneaked off to the casinos, maybe the grass cutter slinked through the house pilfering. Claudia would be at the top of the list. Ray could easily see her easing over to Maple Run whenever the judge beckoned. You don't sleep with a woman for years, then cut her off without a replacement. Their lives had been so connected it was easy to imagine their romance continuing. No one had been closer to Reuben Attlee than Claudia. If anyone knew where the money came from, it was her. If she wanted a key to the house, she could have had one, though a key was not necessary. Her visit on the morning of the funeral could have been for surveillance and not sympathy, though she'd played it well. Tough, smart, savvy, calloused, and old, but not too old. For 15 minutes he dwelt on Claudia and convinced himself that she was the one tracking the money. Two other names came to mind, but Ray could not add them to the list. The first was Harry Rex, and as soon as he mumbled the name, he felt ashamed. The other was Forrest. And it, too, was a ridiculous idea. Forrest had not been inside the house for 9 years. Assuming, just for the sake of argument, that he somehow had known about the money, he would never have left it. Give Forrest $3 million in cash, and he would have done serious damage to himself and those around him. The list took great effort, but there was little to show for it. He wanted to go for a quick run, but instead stuffed some old clothes into 2 pillowcases, then drove to Cheney's, where he unloaded them into 14B. Nothing had been touched. The boxes were just as he had left them the day before. The money was still well hidden. As he loitered there, not wanting to leave until the last second, he was hit with a thought that perhaps he was creating a trail. Obviously, someone knew he had taken it from the judge's study. For that kind of money, private investigators could be hired to follow Ray. They could follow him from Clanton to Charlottesville, from his apartment to Cheney's self-storage. He cursed himself for being so negligent. Think, man. The money doesn't belong to you. He locked up 14B as tightly as possible. Driving across town to meet Carl for lunch, he glanced at his mirrors and watched other drivers, and after 5 minutes of this, he laughed at himself and vowed that he would not live like wounded prey. Let them have the damned money. One less thing to worry about. Break into 14B and haul it away. Wouldn't affect his life in the least. No, sir. Chapter 18. The estimated flying time to Atlantic City was 85 minutes in the Bonanza, which was exactly 35 minutes faster than the Cessna Ray had been renting. Early Saturday morning, he and Fogg did a thorough pre-flight, under the intrusive and often obnoxious supervision of Dick Docker and Charlie Yates, who walked around the Bonanza with their tall styrofoam cups of bad coffee as if they were flying instead of just watching. They had no students that morning, but the gossip around the airport was that Ray was buying the Bonanza and they had to see things for themselves. Hangar gossip was as reliable as coffee shop rumors. How much does he want now? Docker asked in the general direction of Fog Newton, who was crouched under a wing draining a fuel sump, checking for water and dirt in the tanks. He's down to 410, Fog said with an air of importance, because he was in charge of this flight, not them.
Still too high, Yates said.
You gonna make an offer? Docker said to Ray.
Mind your own business, Ray shot back without looking. He was checking the engine oil.
This is our business, Yates said, and they all laughed. In spite of the unsolicited help, the pre-flight was completed without a problem. Fogg climbed in first and buckled himself into the left seat. Ray followed in the right, and when he pulled the door hard and latched it and put on the headset, he knew he had found the perfect flying machine. The 200-horsepower engine started smoothly. Fogg slowly went through the gauges, instruments, and radios, and when they finished a pre-takeoff checklist, he called the tower. He would get it airborne, then turn it over to Ray. The wind was light and the clouds were high and scattered, almost a perfect day for flying. They lifted off the runway at 70 miles per hour, retracted the landing gear, and climbed 800 feet per minute until they reached their assigned cruising altitude of 6,000 feet. By then, Ray had the controls, and Fogg was explaining the autopilot, the radar weather, the traffic collision avoidance system.
She's loaded, Fogg said more than once.
Fogg had flown Marine fighters for one career, but for the past 10 years he'd been relegated to the little Cessnas in which he had taught Ray and 1,000 others to fly. A Bonanza was the Porsche of single engines, and Fogg was delighted for the rare chance to fly one. The route assigned by air traffic control took them just south and east of Washington, away from the busy airspace around Dulles and Reagan National. 30 miles away, and more than a mile up, they could see the dome of the Capitol. Then they were over the Chesapeake with the skyline of Baltimore in the distance. The bay was beautiful, but the inside of the airplane was far more interesting. Ray was flying it himself without the help of the autopilot. He maintained a course, kept the assigned altitude, talked to Washington control, and listened to Fogg chat incessantly about the performance ratings and features of the Bonanza. Both pilots wanted the flight to last for hours, but Atlantic City was soon ahead. Ray descended to 4,000 feet, then to 3,000, and then switched to the approach frequency. With the runway in sight, Fogg took the controls and they glided to a soft touchdown. Taxiing to the general aviation ramp, they passed two rows of small Cessnas, and Ray couldn't help but think that those days were behind him. Pilots were always searching for the next plane, and Ray had found his. Fogg's favorite casino was the Rio, on the boardwalk with several others. They agreed to meet for lunch in a second-floor cafeteria, then quickly lost each other. Each wanted to keep his gambling private. Ray wandered among the slots and scoped out the tables. It was Saturday, and the Rio was busy. He circled around and eased up on the poker tables. Fogg was in a crowd around a table, lost in his cards, with a stack of chips under his hands. Ray had $5,000 in his pocket. 50 of the $100 bills picked at random from the stash he had hauled back from Clanton. His only goal that day was to drop the money in the casinos along the boardwalk and make certain it was not counterfeit, not marked, not traceable in any way. After his visit to Tunica last Monday night, he was fairly certain the money was for real. Now he almost hoped it was marked. If so, then maybe the FBI would track him down and tell him where the money came from. He had done nothing wrong. The guilty party was dead. Bring on the feds. He found an empty chair at a blackjack table and laid 5 bills down for chips. Greens, he said, like a veteran gambler.
Changing 500, the dealer said, barely looking up.
Change it,
came the reply from a pit boss. The tables were busy. Slots were ringing in the background. A crap game was hot off in the distance. Men were yelling at the dice. The dealer picked up the bills as Ray froze for a second. The other players watched with detached admiration. All were playing $5 and $10 chips. Amateurs. The dealer stuffed the judge's bills, all perfectly valid, into the money box and counted $20, $25 green chips for Ray, who lost half of them in the first 15 minutes and left to find some ice cream. down 250 and not the least bit worried about it. He ventured near the crap tables and watched the confusion. He could not imagine his father mastering such a complicated game. Where did one learn to shoot dice in Ford County, Mississippi? According to a thin little gambling guide he'd picked up in a bookstore, a basic wager is a come bet. And when he mustered the courage, he wedged his way between two other gamblers and placed the remaining 10 chips on the pass line. The dice rolled 12, the money was scraped away by the dealer, and Ray left the Rio to visit the princess next door. Inside, the casinos were all the same, old folks staring hopelessly at the slots, just enough coins rattling in the trays to keep them hooked. Blackjack tables crowded with subdued players slugging free beer and whiskey. Serious gamblers packed around the crap tables hollering at the dice. A few Asians playing roulette. Cocktail waitresses in silly costumes showing skin and hauling drinks. He picked out a blackjack table and repeated the procedure. His next 5 bills passed the dealer's inspection. Ray bet $100 on the first hand, but instead of quickly losing his money, he began winning. He had too much untested cash in his pocket to waste time accumulating chips, so when he doubled his money, he pulled out 10 more bills and asked for $100 chips. The dealer informed the pit boss, who offered a gapped smile and said, "Good luck." An hour later, he left the table with 22 chips. Next on his tour was the Forum, an older-looking establishment with an odor of stale cigarette smoke partially masked by cheap disinfectant. The crowd was older, too, because, as he soon realized, the Forum's specialty was quarter slots, and those over 65 got a free breakfast, lunch, or dinner. Take your pick. The cocktail waitresses were on the downhill side of 40 and had given up the notion of showing flesh. They hustled about in what appeared to be track suits with matching sneakers. The limit at blackjack was $10 a hand. The dealer hesitated when he saw Ray's cash hit the table, and he held the first bill up to the light as if he'd finally caught a counterfeiter. The pit boss inspected it, too, and Ray was rehearsing his lines about procuring that particular bill down the street at the Rio. "Cash it," said the pit boss, and the moment passed. He lost $300 in an hour. Fogg claimed to be breaking the casino when they met for a quick sandwich. Ray was down $100, but like all gamblers, lied and said he was up slightly. They agreed to leave at 5 p.m. and fly back to Charlottesville. The last of Ray's cash was converted to chips at a $50 table in Canyon Casino, the newest of those on the boardwalk. He played for a while but soon grew tired of cards and went to the sports bar, where he sipped a soda and watched boxing from Vegas. The $5,000 he brought to Atlantic City had been thoroughly flushed through the system. He would leave with $4,700 and a wide trail. He had been filmed and photographed in 7 casinos. At 2 of them, he had filled in paperwork when cashing in chips at the cashier's windows. At 2 others, he had used his credit cards to make small withdrawals, just to leave more evidence behind. If the judge's cash was traceable, then they would know who he was and where to find him. Fogg was quiet as they rode back to the airport. His luck had turned south during the afternoon. "Lost a couple hundred," he finally admitted, but his demeanor suggested he had lost much more. "You?" he asked. "I had a good afternoon," Ray said. "Won enough to pay for the charter." "That's not bad. Don't suppose I could pay for it in cash, coulda?" "Cash is still legal," Fogg said, perking up a bit. "Then cash it is." During the pre-flight, Fogg asked if Ray wanted to fly in the left seat. "We'll call it a lesson," he said. The prospect of a cash transaction had raised his spirits. Behind 2 commuter flights, Ray taxied the Bonanza into position and waited for traffic to clear. Under the close eye of Fogg, he began the takeoff roll, accelerated to 70 miles per hour, then lifted smoothly into the air. The turbocharged engine seemed twice as powerful as the Cessna's. They climbed with little effort to 7,500 feet and were soon on top of the world. Dick Docker was napping in the cockpit when Ray and Fogg walked in to log the trip and turn in headsets.
He jumped to attention and made his way to the counter.
"Didn't expect you back so soon," he mumbled half asleep as he pulled paperwork from a drawer.
"We broke the casino," Ray said. Fog had disappeared down into the study room of the flight school.
"Gee, I never heard that before."
Ray was flipping through the logbook.
"You paying now?" Dick asked, scribbling numbers.
"Yes, and I want the cash discount."
"Didn't know we had one."
"You do now. It's 10%.
"We can do that."
"Yep, it's the old cash discount."
He figured again, then said,
"Total's $1,320.
Ray was counting money from his wad of bills.
"I don't carry 20s. Here's 13.
As Dick was recounting the money, he said,
"Some guy came poking around today, said he wanted to take lessons, and somehow your name came up."
"Who was he?"
"Never saw him before."
"Why was my name used?"
"It was kind of weird. I was giving him the spiel about cost and such, and out of the blue he asked if you owned an airplane. Said he knew you from someplace."
Ray had both hands on the counter.
"Did you get his name?" "I asked. Doff something or other. Wasn't real clear. Started acting suspicious and finally left. I watched him. He stopped by your car in the parking lot, walked around it like he might break in or something. Then left. You know a Doff?"
"I've never known a Doff."
"Me neither. I've never heard of a Doff. Like I said, it was weird."
"What'd he look like?"
50-ish, small, thin, head full of gray hair, slicked back, dark eyes like a Greek or something. Used car salesman type. Pointed toe boots."
Ray was shaking his head. "Not a clue."
"Why didn't you just shoot him?" Ray asked. "Thought he was a customer."
"Since when are you nice to your customers?"
"You buying the bonanza?"
"Nope.
Just dreaming."
Fog was back and they congratulated each other on a wonderful trip. Promised to do it again, the usual. Driving away, Ray watched every car and every turn. They were following him. Chapter 19. A week passed. A week without FBI or Treasury agents knocking on his door with badges and questions about bad money, tracked down in Atlantic City. A week with no sign of Dolph or anyone else following him. A week of the normal routine of running 5 miles in the morning and being a law professor after that. He flew the Bonanza 3 times, each a lesson with Fog at his right elbow, and each lesson paid for on the spot with cash.
"Casino money," he said with a grin.
And it wasn't a lie. Fog was anxious to return to Atlantic City to reclaim his lost assets. Ray had no interest, but it wasn't a bad idea. He could boast of another good day at the tables and keep paying cash for his flying lessons. The money was now in 37F. 14B was still rented to Ray Attlee, and it still held the old clothes and the cheap furniture. 37F was rented to NDY Ventures, named in honor of the 3 flight instructors at Dockers. Ray's name was nowhere on the paperwork for 37F. He leased it for 3 months in cash.
"I want this confidential," he said to Mrs. Cheney. "Everything's confidential around here. We get all types."
She gave him a conspiratorial look as if to say, "I don't care what you're hiding, just pay me." He had moved it 1 box at a time, hauling it at night under the cover of darkness, with a security guard watching from a distance. Storage space 37F was identical to 14B, and when the 6 boxes were safely tucked away, he had vowed once again to leave it alone and not stop by every day. It had never occurred to him that hauling around $3 million could be such a chore. Harry Rex had not called. He had sent another overnight package with more of the same letters of sympathy and such. Ray was compelled to read them all, or at least scan them just in case there was a second cryptic note. There was not. Exams came and went, and after graduation, the law school would be quiet for the summer. Ray said goodbye to his students, all but Kaylee, who after her last exam informed Ray she had decided to stay in Charlottesville through the summer. She pressed him again for a pre-graduation rendezvous of some sort, just for the hell of it.
"We are waiting until you are no longer a student," Ray said, holding his ground but wanting to yield.
They were in his office with the door open.
"That's a few days away," she said.
"Yes, it is. Then let's pick a date.
No, let's graduate first, then we'll pick a date. She left him with the same lingering smile and look, and Ray knew that she was trouble. Carl Merck caught him gazing down the hall as she walked away in very tight jeans.
Not bad, Carl said.
Ray was slightly embarrassed but kept watching anyway.
She's after me, he said. You're not alone. Be careful.
They were standing in the hallway next to the door to Ray's office. Carl handed him an odd-looking envelope and said,
Thought you'd get a kick out of this.
What is it?
It's an invitation to the Buzzard Ball.
The what? Ray was pulling out the invitation.
The first ever Buzzard Ball. Probably the last, too. It's a black tie gala to benefit the preservation of bird life in the Piedmont. Look at the hosts.
Ray read it slowly. Vicky and Lou Radowski cordially invite you to...
The Liquidator is now saving our birds.
Touching, huh?
$5,000 a couple. I think that's a record for Charlottesville.
It was sent to the dean. He's on the A-list. We are not. Even his wife was shocked at the price.
Susie's shockproof, isn't she?
Or so we thought. They want 200 couples. They'll raise a million or so and show everybody how it's done. That's the plan, anyway. Susie says they'll be lucky to get 30 couples.
She's not going?
No, and the dean is very relieved. He thinks it's the first black tie shindig they'll miss in the last 10 years.
Music by the Drifters, Ray said as he scanned the rest of the invitation. That'll cost him $50,000.
What a fool.
That's Charlottesville. Some clown bails out from Wall Street, gets a new wife, buys a big horse farm, starts throwing money around, and wants to be the big man in a small town.
Well, I'm not going.
You're not invited.
Keep it. Carl was off, and Ray returned to his desk, invitation in hand. He put his feet on his desk, closed his eyes, and began daydreaming. He could see Kaylee in a slinky black dress with no back at all, slits up past her thighs, very low V-neck, drop-dead gorgeous. 13 years younger than Vicky, a hell of a lot fitter, out there on the dance floor with Ray, who was not a bad dancer himself, bobbing and jerking to the Motown rhythms of the Drifters, while everybody watched and whispered, "Who's that?" And in response, Vicky would be forced to drag old Lou out onto the floor. Lou in his designer tux, which could not hide his dumpy little belly. Lou with shrubs of bright gray hair above his ears. Lou the old goat trying to buy respect by saving the birds. Lou with the arthritic back and slow feet who moves like a dump truck. Lou proud of his trophy wife in her million-dollar dress, which reveals too much of her magnificently starved bones. Ray and Kaylee would look much better, dance much better, and, well, what would all that prove? A nice scene to visit, but give it up. Now that he had the money, he wouldn't waste it on nonsense like that. The drive to Washington was only 2 hours, and more than half of it was fairly scenic and enjoyable. But his preferred method of travel had changed. He and Fogg flew the Bonanza for 38 minutes to Reagan National, where they were reluctantly allowed to land, even with a pre-approved slot. Ray jumped in a taxi and 15 minutes later was at the Treasury Department on Pennsylvania Avenue. A colleague at the law school had a brother-in-law with some clout in Treasury. Phone calls had been made, and Mr. Oliver Talbert welcomed Professor Attlee into his rather comfortable office in the BEP, Bureau of Engraving and Printing. The professor was doing research on a vaguely defined project and needed less than an hour of someone's time. Talbert was not the brother-in-law, but he was asked to fill in. They began with the topic of counterfeiting, and in broad strokes Talbert laid out the current problems, almost all blamed on technology, primarily inkjet printers and computer-generated counterfeit currency. He had samples of some of the best imitations. With a magnifier, he pointed out the flaws, the lack of detail in Ben Franklin's forehead, the missing thin thread lines running through the design background, the bleeding ink in the serial numbers.
This is very good stuff, he said, and counterfeiters are getting better.
Where'd you find this? Ray asked, though the question was completely irrelevant. Talbert looked at the tag on the back of the display board.
Mexico, he said, and that was all.
To outpace the counterfeiters, Treasury was investing heavily in its own technology. Printers that gave the bills an almost holographic effect. Watermarks, color-shifting inks, fine-line printing patterns, enlarged off-center portraits, and scanners that could spot a fake in less than a second. The most effective method so far was one that had not yet been used. Simply change the color of the money. Go from green to blue to yellow, then to pink. Gather up the old, flood the banks with the new, and the counterfeiters could not catch up, at least not in Talbert's opinion.
But Congress won't allow it, he said, shaking his head.
Tracing real money was Ray's primary concern, and they eventually got around to it. Money is not actually marked, Talbert explained, for obvious reasons. If the crook could look at the bills and see markings, then the sting would fall apart. Marking simply meant recording serial numbers, once a very tedious task because it was done manually. He told a kidnapping and ransom story. The cash arrived just minutes before the drop was planned. 2 dozen FBI agents worked furiously to write down the serial numbers of the $100 bills. The ransom was $1 million, he was saying, and they simply ran out of time. Got about 80,000 recorded, but it was enough. They caught the kidnappers a month later with some of the marked bills, and that broke the case. But a new scanner had made the job much easier. It photographs 10 bills at a time, 140 seconds. Once the serial numbers are recorded, how do you find the money? Ray asked, taking notes on a yellow legal pad. Would Talbert have expected anything else?
2 ways. First, if you find the crook with the money, you simply put 2 and 2 together and nail him. That's how the DEA and FBI catch drug dealers. Bust a street dealer, cut him a deal, give him 20,000 in marked bills to buy coke from his supplier, then catch the bigger fish holding the government's money.
What if you don't catch the crook? Ray asked, and in doing so, could not help but think of his departed father.
That's the second way, and it's much more difficult. Once the money is lifted out of circulation by the Federal Reserve, a sample of it is routinely scanned. If a marked bill is found, it can be traced back to the bank that submitted it. By then, it's too late. Occasionally, a person with marked money will use it in one general location over a period of time, and we've caught a few crooks that way.
Sounds like a long shot.
Very much so, Talbert admitted.
I read a story a few years ago about some duck hunters who stumbled across a wrecked airplane, a small one, Ray said casually. The tale had been rehearsed. There was some cash on board. Seems like it was almost $1 million. They figured it was drug money, so they kept it. Turns out they were right. The money was marked, and it soon surfaced in their small town.
I think I remember that, Talbert said.
I must be good, thought Ray. My question is this. Could they, or could anyone else who finds money, simply submit it to the FBI or DEA or Treasury and have it scanned to see if it was marked, and if so, where it came from?
Talbert scratched his cheek with a bony finger and contemplated the question, then shrugged and said,
I don't see why they couldn't. The problem, though, is obvious. They would run the risk of losing the money.
I'm sure it's not a common occurrence, Ray said, and they both laughed.
Talbert had a story about a judge in Chicago who was skimming from the lawyers small sums, $500 and $1,000 a pop, to get cases moved up the docket and for friendly rulings. He had done it for years before the FBI got a tip. They busted some of the lawyers and convinced them to play along. Serial numbers were taken from the bills, and during the 2-year operation, $350,000 was sneaked across the bench into the judge's sticky fingers. When the raid happened, the money had vanished. Someone tipped the judge. The FBI eventually found the money in the judge's brother's garage in Arizona, and everybody went to jail. Ray caught himself squirming. Was it a coincidence, or was Talbert trying to tell him something? But as the narrative unfolded, he relaxed and tried to enjoy it, close as it was. Talbert knew nothing about Ray's father. Riding in a cab back to the airport, Ray did the math on his legal pad. For a judge like the one in Chicago, it would take 18 years stealing at the rate of $175,000 a year to accumulate $3 million. And that was Chicago, with 100 courts and thousands of wealthy lawyers,
handling cases worth much more than the ones in North Mississippi. The judicial system there was an industry where things could slip through, heads could be turned, wheels greased. In Judge Attlee's world, a handful of people did everything, and if money was offered or taken, folks would know about it. $3 million could not be taken from the 25th Chancery District because there wasn't that much in the system to begin with. He decided that one more trip to Atlantic City was necessary. He would take even more cash and flush it through the system. A final test. He had to be certain the judge's money wasn't marked. Fogg would be thrilled. Chapter 20. When Vicky fled and moved in with the liquidator, a professor friend recommended Axel Sullivan as a divorce specialist. Axel proved to be a fine lawyer, but there wasn't much he could do on the legal front. Vicky was gone, she wasn't coming back, and she didn't want anything from Ray. Axel supervised the paperwork, recommended a good shrink, and did a commendable job of getting Ray through the ordeal. According to Axel, the best private investigator in town was Corey Crawford, a black ex-cop who had pulled time for a beating. Crawford's office was above a bar his brother owned near the campus. It was a nice bar with a menu and unpainted windows, live music on the weekends, no unseemly traffic other than a bookie who worked the college crowd. But Ray parked 3 blocks away just the same. He did not want to be seen entering the premises. A sign that read Crawford Investigations pointed to stairs on one side of the building. There was no secretary, or at least none was present. He was 10 minutes early, but Crawford was waiting. He was in his late 30s with a shaved head and handsome face, no smile whatsoever. He was tall and lean, and his expensive clothes were well fitted. A large pistol was strapped to his waist in a black leather holster. "I think I'm being followed," Ray began.
"This is not a divorce."
They were on opposite sides of a small table in a small office that overlooked the street.
"No. Who would want to follow you?"
He had rehearsed a story about family trouble back in Mississippi, a dead father, some inheritances that may or may not happen, jealous siblings, a rather vague tale that Crawford seemed to buy none of. Before he could ask questions, Ray told him about Dolph at the airport and gave him his description.
"Sounds like Rusty Waddle," Crawford said.
"And who's that?"
"Private eye from Richmond. Not very good. Does some work around here. Based on what you've said, I don't think your family would hire someone from Charlottesville. It's a small town."
The name of Rusty Waddle was duly recorded and locked away forever in Ray's memory.
"Is there a chance that these bad guys back in Mississippi would want you to know that you're being followed?" Crawford asked.
Ray looked completely baffled, so Crawford continued.
"Sometimes we get hired to intimidate, to frighten. Sounds like Waddle or whoever it was wanted your buddies at the airport to give you a good description. Maybe he left a trail."
"I guess it's possible."
"What do you want me to do?"
"Determine if someone is following me. If so, who is it and who's paying for it?
The first two might be easy. The third might be impossible."
"Let's give it a try." Crawford opened a thin file.
"I charge $100 an hour," he said, his eyes staring right through Ray's, looking for indecision. "Plus expenses. And a retainer of $2,000.
"I prefer to deal in cash," Ray said, staring right back, "if that's acceptable." The first hint of a smile.
"In my business, cash is always preferred."
Crawford filled in some blanks in a contract. "Would they tap my phone, stuff like that?" Ray asked.
"We'll search everything. Get another cell phone, digital, and don't register it in your name. Most of our correspondence will be by cell phone."
"What a surprise," Ray mumbled, taking the contract, scanning it, then signing. Crawford put it back in the file and returned to his notepad.
"For the first week, we'll coordinate your movements. Everything will be planned. Go about your normal routine. Just give us notice so we can have people in place."
"I'll have a traffic jam behind me," Ray thought. "It's a pretty dull life," Ray said. "I jog, I go to work, sometimes I go fly an airplane. I go home, alone, no family."
"Other places?"
Sometimes I do lunch, dinner. Not a breakfast guy, though.
You're putting me to sleep, Crawford said and almost smiled.
Women?
I wish. Maybe a prospect or two, nothing serious.
If you find one, give them my name.
These bad guys in Mississippi, they're looking for something. What is it?
It's an old family with lots of stuff handed down. Jewelry, rare books, crystal and silver. It sounded natural, and this time Crawford bought it.
Now we're getting somewhere. And you have possession of the family heirloom?
That's right.
It's here?
Tucked away in Cheney's self-storage on Berkshire Road.
What's it worth?
Not nearly as much as my relatives think.
Give me a ballpark.
$500,000 on the high side.
And you have a legitimate claim to it?
Let's say the answer is yes. Otherwise, I'll be forced to give you the family history, which could take the next 8 hours and give us both a migraine.
Fair enough.
Crawford finished a lengthy paragraph and was ready to wrap things up.
When can you get a new cell phone?
I'll go now.
Great.
And when can we check your apartment?
Anytime.
3 hours later, Crawford and a sidekick he called Booty finished what was known as a sweep. Ray's phones were clear, no taps or bugs. The air vents hid no secret cameras. In the cramped attic, they found no receivers or monitors hidden behind boxes.
You're clean, Crawford said as he left.
He didn't feel very clean as he sat on his balcony. You open up your life to complete strangers, albeit some selected and paid by you, and you feel compromised. The phone was ringing. Forrest sounded sober. Strong voice, clear words. As soon as he said, "Hello, bro," Ray listened to see what kind of shape he was in. It was instinctive now, after years of phone calls at all hours from all places, many of which he, Forrest, never remembered. He said he was fine, which meant he was sober and clean, no booze or drugs, but he did not say for how long. Ray was not about to ask. Before either could mention the judge or his estate or the house or Harry Rex, Forrest blurted out,
"I got a new racket."
"Tell me about it," Ray said, settling into his recliner. The voice on the other end was full of excitement. Ray had plenty of time to listen.
"Ever heard of Benalatifix?"
"No."
"Me neither. The nickname is Skinny Ben. Ring a bell?"
"No, sorry."
"It's a diet pill put out by a company called Luray Products out of California, a big private outfit that no one's ever heard of. For the last 5 years, doctors have been prescribing Skinny Bens like crazy because the drug works. It's not for the woman who needs to drop 20 pounds, but it does wonders for the really obese, talking linebackers, defensive ends. You there?"
"I'm listening."
"Trouble is, after a year or two, these poor women develop leaky heart valves. Tens of thousands of them have been treated, and Luray is getting sued like crazy in California and Florida. Food and Drug stepped in 8 months ago, and last month Luray yanked Skinny Bens off the market."
"Where exactly do you come in, Forrest?"
"I'm now a medical screener."
"And what does a medical screener do?"
"Thanks for asking. Today, for example, I was in a hotel suite in Dyersburg, Tennessee, helping these hefty darlings onto a treadmill. The doctor, paid by the lawyers who pay me, checks their heart capacity, and if they're not up to snuff, guess what?"
"You have a new client."
"Absolutely. Signed up 40 today."
"What's the average case worth?"
"About $10,000. The lawyers I'm now working with have 800 cases. That's $8 million. The lawyers get half, the women get screwed again. Welcome to the world of mass torts."
"What's in it for you?"
"A base salary, a bonus for new clients, and a piece of the back end. There could be $500,000 cases out there, so we're scrambling to round them up."
"That's $5 billion in claims."
"Luray's got 8 in cash. Every plaintiff's lawyer in the country is talking about Skinny Bens."
"Aren't there some ethical problems?"
"There are no ethics anymore, bro. You in la-la land. Ethics are only for people like you to teach to students who'll never use them. I hate to be the one to break it to you."
"I've heard it before."
"Anyway, I'm mining for gold. Just thought you'd want to know."
"That's good to hear."
Is anybody up there doing skinny bends?
Not to my knowledge.
Keep your eyes open. These lawyers are teaming up with other lawyers around the country. That's how mass tort stuff works, as I'm learning. The more cases you have in a class, the bigger the settlement.
I put out the word.
See you, bro.
Be careful, Forrest.
The next call came shortly after 2:30 a.m., and like every call at such an hour, the phone seemed to ring forever, both during sleep and afterward. Ray finally managed to grab it and switch on a light.
Ray, this is Harry Rex. Sorry to call.
What is it? He said, knowing too well that it was not good.
Forrest, I've spent the last hour talking to him and some nurse at Baptist Hospital in Memphis. They've got him there, I think, with a broken nose.
Back up, Harry Rex.
He went to a bar, got drunk, got in a fight, the usual. Looks like he picked on the wrong guy, and now he's getting his face stitched up. They want to keep him overnight. I had to talk to the staff there and guarantee payment. I also asked them not to give him painkillers and drugs. They have no idea who they've got there.
I'm sorry you're in the middle of this, Harry Rex.
I've been here before, and I don't mind. But he's crazy, Ray. He started again about the estate and how he's getting screwed out of his rightful share, all that crap. I know he's drunk and all, but he just won't leave it alone.
I talked to him 5 hours ago. He was fine.
Well, he must have been headed for the bar. They finally had to sedate him to reset his nose, otherwise it would have been impossible. I'm just worried about all the drugs and stuff. What a mess.
I'm sorry, Harry Rex, Ray said again, because he could think of nothing else to say. There was a pause as Ray tried to collect his thoughts. He was fine, just a few hours ago. Clean, sober. Seems so, anyway.
Did he call you? Harry Rex asked.
Yeah, he was excited about a new job.
That skinny Ben crap?
Yeah. Is it a real job?
I think so. There are a bunch of lawyers down here chasing those cases. Quantity's crucial. They hire guys like Forrest to go out and round them up.
They ought to be disbarred.
Half of us should. I think you need to come home. The sooner we can open the estate, the sooner we can get Forrest calmed down. I hate these accusations.
Do you have a court date?
We can do it Wednesday of next week. I think you ought to stay for a few days.
I was planning on it. Book it. I'll be there.
I'll notify Forrest in a day or so. Try to catch him sober.
Sorry, Harry Rex. Not surprisingly, Ray couldn't sleep. He was reading a biography when his new cell phone rang. Had to be a wrong number.
Hello?
He said suspiciously.
Why are you awake? Asked the deep voice of Corey Crawford.
Because my phone keeps ringing.
Where are you?
We're watching. You okay?
I'm fine. It's almost 4 a.m. You guys ever sleep?
We nap a lot. I'd keep the lights out if I were you.
Thank you. Anybody else watching my lights?
Not yet.
That's good.
Just checking in.
Ray turned off the lights in the front of his apartment and retreated to his bedroom, where he read with aid of a small lamp. Sleep was made even more difficult with the knowledge that he was being billed $100 an hour through the night. It's a wise investment, he kept telling himself. At exactly 5 a.m., he sneaked down his hallway as if someone on the ground down there might see him, and he brewed coffee in the dark. Waiting for the first cup, he called Crawford, who, not surprisingly, sounded groggy.
I'm brewing coffee. You want some? Ray asked.
Not a good idea, but thanks.
Look, I'm flying to Atlantic City this afternoon. You got a pen?
Yeah, let's have it.
I'm leaving from General Aviation in a white Beach Bonanza, tail number 815 Romeo, at 3 p.m., with a flight instructor named Fogg Newton. We'll stay tonight at the Canyon Casino and return around noon tomorrow. I'll leave my car at the airport locked as usual. Anything else?
You want us in Atlantic City?
No, that's not necessary. I'll move around a lot up there and try to watch my rear.
Chapter 21 The consortium was put together by one of Dick Docker's flying buddies. It was built around two local ophthalmologists who had clinics in West Virginia. Both had just learned to fly and needed to shuttle back and forth at a faster pace.
Docker's pal was a pension consultant who needed the bonanza for about 12 hours a month. A fourth partner would get the deal off the ground. Each would put up $50,000 for a quarter interest, then sign a bank loan for the balance of the purchase price, which was currently at $390,000, and not likely to move lower. The note was spread over 6 years and would cost each partner $890 per month. That was about 11 hours in a Cessna for Pilot Attlee. On the plus side, there was depreciation and potential charter business when the partners were not using the plane. On the negative, there were hangar fees, fuel, maintenance, and a list that seemed to go on too long. Unsaid by the pal of Dick Docker, and also very much on the negative side, was the possibility of getting into business with three strangers, two of whom were doctors. But Ray had $50,000, and he could swing $890 a month, and he wanted desperately to own the airplane that he secretly considered to be his. Bonanzas held their value, according to a rather persuasive report that was attached to the proposal. Demand had remained high in the used aircraft market. The Beech safety record was second only to Cessna, and practically as strong. Ray carried the consortium deal around with him for 2 days, reading it at the office, in his apartment, at the lunch counter. The other three partners were in. Just sign his name in four places, and he would own the bonanza. The day before he left for Mississippi, he studied the deal for the last time, said to hell with everything else, and signed the papers. If the bad guys were watching him, they were doing an excellent job of covering their tracks. After 6 days of trying to find the surveillance, Corey Crawford was of the opinion that there was nobody back there. Ray paid him $3,800 in cash and promised to call if he got suspicious again. Under the guise of storing more junk, he went to Cheney's self-storage every day to check on the money. He hauled in boxes filled with anything he could find around his apartment. Both 14B and 37F were slowly taking on the appearance of an old attic. The day before he left town, he went to the front office and asked Mrs. Cheney if someone had vacated 18R. Yes, 2 days ago. "I'd like to rent it," he said.
"That makes three," she said.
"I'm going to need the space."
"Why don't you just rent one of our larger units?"
"Maybe later. For now, I'll use the three small ones." It really didn't matter to her. He rented 18R in the name of Newton Aviation and paid cash for a 6-month lease. When he was certain no one was watching, he moved the money out of 37F and into 18R, where new boxes were waiting. They were made of aluminum-coated vinyl and guaranteed to resist fire up to 300 degrees Fahrenheit. They were also waterproof, and they locked. The money fit into five of them. For good measure, Ray threw some old quilts and blankets and clothes over the boxes so things would look a little more normal. He wasn't sure whom he was trying to impress with the randomness of his little room, but he felt better when it looked disheveled. A lot of what he was doing these days was for the benefit of someone else. A different route from his apartment to the law school, a new jogging trail, a different coffee bar, a new downtown bookstore to browse through, and always with an eye for the unusual, an eye in the rearview mirror, a quick turnaround when he walked or jogged, a peek through shelves after he entered a shop. Someone was back there. He could feel it. He had decided to have dinner with Kaylee before he went south for a while, and before she technically became a former student. Exams were over. What was the harm? She would be around for the summer, and he was determined to pursue her with great caution. Caution because that's what every female got from him. Caution because he thought he saw potential in this one. But the first phone call to her number was a disaster. A male voice answered. A younger voice, Ray thought. And whoever he wasn't too pleased that Ray had called. When Kaylee got on the phone, she was abrupt. Ray asked if he could call at a better time. She said no, she'd ring him back. He waited 3 days, then wrote her off, something he could do as easily as flipping the calendar to the next month. So he departed Charlottesville with nothing left undone. With Fogg in the bonanza, he flew 4 hours to Memphis, where he rented a car and went to look for Forrest. His first and only visit to the home of Ellie Crum had been for the same purpose as this one. Forrest had cracked up, disappeared, and his family was curious as to whether he might be dead or thrown in jail somewhere. The judge was still presiding back then, and life was normal, including the hunt for Forrest. Of course, the judge had been too busy to search for his youngest son, and why should he when Ray could do it? The house was an old Victorian in Midtown Memphis, a hand-me-down from Ellie's father who had once been prosperous. Not much else was inherited. Forrest had been attracted to the notion of trust funds and real family money, but after 15 years he'd given up hope. In the early days of the arrangement, he had lived in the main bedroom. Now his quarters were in the basement. Others lived in the house, too, all rumored to be struggling artists in need of refuge. Ray parked by the curb in the street. The shrubs needed trimming and the roof was old, but the house was aging nicely. Forrest painted it every October, always in a dazzling color scheme he and Ellie would argue over for a year. Now it was a pale blue trimmed with reds and oranges. Forrest said he painted it teal one year. A young woman with snow-white skin and black hair greeted him at the door with a rude, "Yes?" Ray was looking at her through a screen. Behind her, the house was dark and eerie, same as last time. "Is Ellie in?" Ray asked as rudely as possible.
"She's busy. Who's calling?"
"I'm Ray Atley, Forrest's brother."
"Who?"
"Forrest. He lives in the basement."
"Oh, that Forrest."
She disappeared and Ray heard voices somewhere in the back of the house. Ellie was wearing a bedsheet, white with streaks and spots of clay and water, and slits for her head and arms. She was drying her hands on a dirty dish towel and looked frustrated that her work had been interrupted.
"Hello, Ray,"
she said like an old friend and opened the door.
"Hello, Ellie."
He followed her through the foyer and into the living room.
"Trudy, bring us some tea, will you?"
she called out. Wherever Trudy was, she didn't answer. The walls of the room were covered with a collection of the wackiest pots and vases Ray had ever seen. Forrest said she sculpted 10 hours a day and couldn't give the stuff away.
"I'm sorry about your father," she said.
They sat across a small glass table from each other. The table was unevenly mounted on 3 phallic cylinders, each a different shade of blue. Ray was afraid to touch it.
"Thank you," he said stiffly.
No calls, no cards, no letters, no flowers, not one word of sympathy uttered until now, in this happenstance meeting. An opera could barely be heard in the background.
"I guess you're looking for Forrest," she said.
"Yes."
"I haven't seen him lately. He lives in the basement, you know. Comes and goes like an old tomcat. I sent a girl down this morning to have a look. She says she thinks he's been gone for a week or so. The bed hadn't been made in 5 years.
"That's more than I wanted to know.
And he hasn't called."
Trudy arrived with the tea tray, another of Ellie's hideous creations, and the cups were mismatched little pots with large handles.
"Cream and sugar?"
she asked, pouring and stirring.
"Just sugar."
She handed him his brew, and he took it with both hands. Dropping it would have crushed a foot.
"How is he?" Ray asked when Trudy was gone. "He's drunk. He's sober. He's Forrest."
"Drugs?"
"Don't go there. You don't want to know."
"You're right," Ray said and tried to sip his tea. It was peach-flavored something, and one drop was enough. "He was in a fight the other night. Did you know about it? I think he broke his nose."
"It's been broken before. Why do men get drunk and beat up each other?"
It was an excellent question, and Ray had no answer. She gulped her tea and closed her eyes to savor it. Many years ago, Ellie Crum had been a lovely woman, but now in her late 40s, she had stopped trying.
"You don't care for him, do you?" Ray asked.
"Of course I do."
"No, really. Is it important?"
"He's my brother. No one else cares about him."
"We had great sex in the early years. Then we just lost interest. I got fat. Now I'm too involved with my work."
Ray glanced around the room.
"And besides, there's always sex," she said, nodding to the door from which Trudy had come and gone. "Forrest is a friend, Ray. I suppose I love him at some level, but he's also an addict who seems determined to always be an addict. After a point, you get frustrated.
I know. Believe me, I know.
And I think he's one of the rare ones. He's strong enough to pick himself up at the last possible moment.
But not strong enough to kick it.
Exactly. I kicked it, Ray, 15 years ago. Addicts are tough on each other. That's why he's in the basement.
He's probably happier down there, Ray thought.
He thanked her for the tea and the time, and she walked him to the door. She was still standing there behind the screen when he raced away.
Chapter 22. The estate of Reuben Vincent Attlee was opened for probate in the courtroom where he had presided for 32 years. High on the oak-paneled wall behind the bench, a grim-faced Judge Attlee looked down upon the proceedings from between the Stars and Stripes and the state flag of Mississippi. It was the same portrait they had placed near his coffin during the courthouse wake 3 weeks earlier. Now it was back where it belonged, in a place where it would undoubtedly hang forever. The man who had ended his career and sent him into exile and seclusion at Maple Run was Mike Farr from Holly Springs. He had been re-elected once and, according to Harry Rex, was doing a credible job. Chancellor Farr reviewed the petition for letters of administration, and he studied the one-page will attached to the filings. The courtroom was busy with lawyers and clerks milling about, filing papers and chatting with clients. It was a day set aside for uncontested matters and quick motions. Ray sat in the front row while Harry Rex was at the bench, whispering back and forth with Chancellor Farr. Next to Ray was Forrest, who, other than the faded bruises under his eyes, looked as normal as possible. He had insisted that he would not be present when probate was opened, but a tongue-lashing from Harry Rex had persuaded him otherwise. He had finally come home to Ellie's, the usual return from the streets without a word to anyone about where he'd been or what he'd been up to. No one wanted to know. There was no mention of a job, so Ray was assuming his brief career as a medical screener for the Skinny Ben lawyers was over. Every 5 minutes, a lawyer would crouch in the aisle, stick out a hand, and tell Ray what a fine man his father had been. Of course, Ray was supposed to know all of them because they knew him. No one spoke to Forrest. Harry Rex motioned for Ray to join them at the bench. Chancellor Farr greeted him warmly.
"Your father was a fine man and a great judge," he said, leaning down.
"Thank you," Ray replied. "Then why, during the campaign, did you say he was too old and out of touch?" Ray wanted to ask. It had been 9 years earlier and seemed like 50. With the passing of his father, everything in Ford County was now decades older.
"You teach law?" Chancellor Farr asked.
"Yes, at the University of Virginia." He nodded his approval and asked,
"All the heirs are present?"
"Yes, sir," answered Ray. "It's just my brother Forrest and myself."
"And both of you have read this one-page document that purports to be the last will and testament of Reuben Attlee?"
"Yes, sir."
"And there is no objection to this will being probated?"
"No, sir."
"Very well. Pursuant to this will, I will appoint you as the executor of your late father's estate.